Yeah, let's see. Pants, I'm ready to go.
Wait,
your checklist?
We have to wear pants? Hang on, I need a few minutes.
So, Don, guess what?
Yeah.
Last night, my boss called me around 9 p.m. and we talked for about 3 hours prepping all the stuff for our Monday meetings. Sound familiar?
Oh, Christ.
That's my life today. And you know what? I have no complaints because I enjoy what I do.
Well, yeah, that's the way it is. So are we officially starting right now?
Is this the show?
Yeah. Is this the show? Does it?
Well, there was some feedback about the last episode that I think was primarily from people who didn't listen to the last episode. But there was a gentleman who blogged about it who said, wow, that sounds like tough working conditions. And this
the
was
key
you guys
thing here, though, is I think a lot of people missed is Nitin and I were talking about what it's like in management, for one thing. Right.
Specifically, not even just first level managers. Right.
Yeah.
Yes.
We were directors. We were talking about what it's like as mid-level managers at Apple, particularly mid-level managers in the OS software engineering group, which is just like everything else on steroids, right? There's another issue here, too.
Well, I should just point out, I know plenty of people at Apple who work, maybe not a lot of people, but I know people who work 9-to-5 jobs at Apple, you know, just like normal, regular people.
Yeah, yeah. And right. I had people that... I had one of the most productive engineers that ever worked for me at any company. And I got him to work for me again at Apple. And this guy was a master at working 9-to-5 and outdoing, you know, people who would put in, you know, half again as many hours. He was just, he figured it out. He was so productive. And I never punished him for that. Certainly. And I never wanted him to work more hours. What I told him was, John, whatever it is you're doing, you just keep doing that. Do you need any towels or anything? You know, is there anything I can get you? And some people are like that. They can do that. Management, excuse me, is a little bit different. And this is why I always, you know, make those, make light of that sometimes about what a hard job management is, trying to be funny, of course, but I'm also trying to be truthful and warn people if you want to go into management, you have to take that job very, very seriously because you're responsible for other people. It's not something you ever want to screw up. And we certainly got that message at Apple. And there's another thing to remember is that for me, that was the only perspective I ever had at Apple because when I started at Apple, I was at the very bottom of the management chain, but I was a manager. I was never an engineer at Apple. I started at Apple as a manager with one direct report. It doesn't get more basement management. That was Ken Kishinda, of course. So, sort of followed Scott Forstall up the chain. And so my perspective may be a little bit different than other people. But people said that really bugged me, that I heard the characterization. I think Nitin was on CNBC, right? The guy who said complaining. That just pissed me off. You and I aren't complaining, right?
Well, yeah. So no, we're not. We complain about a lot of things. I complain about a lot of things.
The temperature of wine, for example.
Yes.
I certainly didn't complain about that. And I think, I mean, I could go off on this as well. I mean, one of the things I wanted to bring up for starters was my lovely wife. She's from Wisconsin. And her father, this will tie in a second, so please bear with me.
Run with it.
Her father is a dairy farmer. He owns his own dairy farm in southern Wisconsin, and he's and there are a few other privately owned dairy farms here and there. But by and large, if you know anything about the industry, it's pretty much been taken over by corporate farms. And so, if you have a dairy farm, you're working harder than you probably ever have had to. just to stay competitive. And so, you know, it always gave me this perspective. And I've been married for 14 years now.
Don't get this wrong. She'll listen.
she won't listen. That's the good part. But anyway, but yes. But the whole time that I've we've been married, twice a year, I go to Wisconsin and I see what real hard work is like, right? I mean, cows do not take Christmas off. Cows don't get the week of Thanksgiving off. They don't decide to just stop that. And there's always way too much work to do on a dairy farm. And I actually for a while, for the first few years that I would go out there, I kind of had a hang up about it because I was surrounded by people who were just busting their asses, and here I am. I have the luxury of driving to work. I sit in a nice air-conditioned office. Yes, I'm using my brain, and I'm, you know, and all that. But by and large, I'm not working anywhere near as hard as people in farming. And so that was always just a great reminder that no matter how much it may stink that you got to check your mail. You know, if you're director level or above, you've got to check your mail if you're on vacation or, you know, boohoo. I had to answer a couple of emails on a Sunday afternoon. I always understood that was absolutely nothing compared to the vast majority of jobs that people can have out there. So that's specifically why that rubbed me the wrong way, because I feel like I've never complained about it. If anything, I've been appreciative of the fact that you know, our jobs have been so light on the labor side.
It's much easier than in some regards to certainly the way my father made a living. And, you know, I've always been chasing that old man, considering how hard he worked. I never worked that hard. But the other thing about the complaining aspect is I wasn't trying to complain. It might have sounded like that because I was trying to be funny. You know, that's just my humor vanity. But I was trying to explain to people that if you really want to do this, that's why I made the joke about the Faustian bargain. You know, there's trade-offs there. You're not going to get the time that you want being a manager or executive. You've got to give that up. Now, would I do it again? Yeah, I'd probably do it again, even though I missed out at time with my family then. Trust me, working that hard, you know, that's one of the reasons I was able to retire when I was 55 years old. You know, I'm probably going to go at the same age my dad did just because of genetics, and that was 70. So, you know, you have to make the call. And so I'm never going to complain about Apple that way. The other reason I'm not going to complain is, you know, I've got a stake in Apple. I'm still a shareholder, like I'm sure you are too.
Yeah.
The hell would I complain about it? Well, it's just and also, fundamentally not in my self-interest. So that kind of stuff just pissed me off like you wouldn't believe. And the other thing is, anybody that reads the stuff that I have written, although I haven't written dick lately, on my blog or has listened to me at a conference knows there's only one damn thing I've ever complained about with Apple. And Renee, you and Guy got to hear this firsthand at NS North this year. And you probably remember what it was. It was the secrecy, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
The secrecy at Apple was one of the things that always grated on my nerves. And I'll, you know, complain about that because hopefully, you know, they'll finally get that out of control.
Because it makes it harder to get the job done?
Yeah, it makes it harder to get the job done. And I think it was counterproductive. But, you know, in terms of complaining, that's about it for me with Apple. Because anything else that I notice in a piece of software that I think about a policy, I'm never going to say it publicly anyway. You know, I know the people who are responsible for it. I'll go get their ear and yell at them. And why would that? Why the hell
waste time with us?
Yeah. Why the hell would I make that public? So complaining, really wrong. But there's also a fourth thing that I wanted people to realize. And I hinted at that when I was talking about the second subject here, is because I'm still essentially a very minor stakeholder in Apple, and I care about the company so much, one of the reasons I was trying to paint the job as hard is, I'll be blunt, I only want good people working there. I mean, I want you to know what it's going to be like and what it's going to cost you. And if some people say, you know, I don't want to pay that price, one, they might be smarter than I was. And the other is that, you know, maybe that's good, because I don't think Apple is going to change anytime soon. It's just the way they are. And like I said, the last show, that's just the way the tech industry is too.
One of the things is that, so there are a couple things. First of all, when I was doing the job, and when I was, answering emails on Sundays and all of that, you know, let's not forget, I mean, this is my dream job. You know, when I was, I had first played with an Apple II when I was, I think, 11 years old, something like that. And, you know, if you were a kid growing up in the 80s, especially if you were a nerdy kid growing up in the 80s, you just had nothing but admiration for Apple and for, you know, this mythical Steve Jobs character. And so to think that later in life, like, you know, at that time, I never, ever would have imagined, I could have never imagined that not only would I be working for and occasionally with Steve Jobs later on in life, but that I would be working on a product like the iPhone. I mean, this is like a fairy tale on top of a fairy tale. And because it was a fairy tale, there was this fever. I mean, I just had this fever that made it so that, you know, you want to have the best possible product. And especially when this company that I loved was going down the toilet and was starting to come back and make a recovery, and some of the things were going right, but there was still a lot wrong. That drove me even more, right? I mean, those were the times when I think a lot of the kind of the later work ethic kicked in. You know, I don't think Apple was like that from 1992 when I joined until 97. I'm not sure, because I certainly wasn't a director, so I really don't know. But I'm guessing that sense of urgency came because there was this existential threat that, you know, the company in a very real way almost went out of
business. Turns out it wasn't so existential, was it?
And so really, I mean, you know, there's this sense of urgency you get when the thing that you love, the company that you've loved since you were a little kid, might go out of business. And maybe if I work a little bit harder, or maybe if I do a little bit better job on, you know, this OS 10 thing, or if I fix a few more bugs in this older release, or if we can really kick ass and get, you know, and I can hire some great people and get them working on iPhone, then maybe we can improve the situation and give ourselves a little bit more breathing room and, you know, kind of stop the naysayers. And remember, I mean, I think it's hard to, it's getting harder to remember those times at Apple, right? When Apple was just at war and Apple was almost dead. I mean, how many more metaphors can I mix in here? But
No. I love the fact that you've got that longer perspective too, that I don't. I mean, I joined in 2001, which some would say, you know, that was the beginning of the rise up, not because I joined certainly, but it just, we couldn't have gotten any lower than that. And nobody was really taking, you know, the Bondi Max that seriously. People were still making fun of them and stuff like that. But you got to see the whole plateau, the plunge, and the climb out. And that's just a really unique perspective, Nitin.
Right. And when I was there, you know, just to give a little more perspective, Apple, by the time when I got there, so Scully was still CEO. And Apple was just about done trying to be an enterprise company. But do you remember? I'm not sure if you remember, but for a while, like in the early 90s, Apple wanted to be digital, or they wanted to be
a digital equipment corporation for all you kids out there. That's what he meant.
Exactly. They wanted to
not
be
go digital. It was the name of a company once back in the day.
Thank you, Don. Apple wanted to be that company. They wanted to be enterprise heavy. They were chasing the dollars, and that was just a prime example of Apple kind of getting away from the things that had made them successful in the past, right? They were just chasing this market. And after a while, they realized that, well, nobody's really taking them seriously in the enterprise market, and they're still just hemorrhaging cash and losing market share, and all, you know, all signs were pointing negative. And so, you know, to go from that to, you know, the failed OS efforts that were Copeland and Taligent and other ones, and then to be, you know, to go in, you know, to see the next acquisition and sort of how that played out. Yeah, I mean, the whole time it was, you know, by the time we got to the next acquisition, probably even a little before that, that was when I really, like, in a big way, started feeling sort of that sense of urgency. Like, what can we do? Like, what is it that we can do to actually, you know, from an engineering level, from a very low level engineering level, what can I be doing to help this company kind of limp along and do great things? And nice. and luckily that stuck with the company and got even, you know, and finally the company actually learned how to really execute. Later on, which I think, by the way, maybe one of the untold stories about, you know, about Apple's success is, you know, design is fantastic and things like that. But that's probably probably a topic for another podcast. But nobody gives Apple the credit for execution that I really think they deserve.
Yeah, everybody talks about creativity, innovation, all this foofly shit.
Right.
The thing that I saw from being inside is that Apple learned how to be really good at just getting shit done, and especially getting shit done with an absolute minimum number of people, because overall, Steve Jobs was a rather cheap sort of guy. I mean, we didn't have a lot of stuff when I first arrived there. I mean, you know, we had, the goodies, a lot of the goodies came later. I mean, and a lot of us, a lot of people now who are Apple don't realize that, you know, it was kind of like a Busby Berkeley, you know, Mickey Rooney musical, let's put on a show. You know, we were just doing it on a shoestring sometimes. And it was amazing. We were actually able to pull off some of this shit. So.
And some of that is actually what I'm the most proud of. I consider myself kind of a cheap guy as well. And so one of the things that I've always loved is that, you know, when some of the, you know, some of the quarterly numbers were picked apart and the rest of the industry figured out how much Apple was actually spending on R&D compared to how much Microsoft was spending on R&D and what Apple got for their money and what Microsoft got for their money. I mean, it was just, you know, for me, that was very rewarding because it was, you know, I don't think you need to splash around huge amounts of money for, you know, to be successful. And you know, honestly, it kind of pisses me off about a lot of, you know, sort of the startup and the VC culture these days is, you know, what's your burn rate and can you spend more money faster because you have it? You know, it's just sort of, it's a very silly thing to me and it just is never, it's just never, you know, it's just never sat right with me. And so,
I think the burn rate thing is different from the R&D thing though, right?
Oh yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I guess my point is more just treating money as a, you know, as this renewable resource.
You don't want to treat money as something you use to heat your house, right? By burning it.
Yes.
So, for me, it wasn't that odd a thing going to Apple like that and having that mentality there in 2001, because I'd just come from a startup that went, you know, augured into the desert floor at high speed, easel. And so, and we were just, you know, we were having to pay for our own lunches and stuff there for a while.
Oh, the humanity.
Oh, yeah, exactly. The humanity. And it only bugged me when I would have to go through loops, sometimes justifying some equipment or additional headcount for what was a critical project. Now, the iPhone project, we were a little better off then when we started iPhone, but the hoops that we had to jump to were not because of money, because Steve was willing at that time for the iPhone to spend whatever it took. The issue was secrecy and security and trust, right? He wouldn't allow us to hire people from the outside, essentially. So it was a little weird there in the beginning.
Yeah, but even on iPhone, I specifically remember one time going out with a few engineers on my team. We went to Fry's to go buy bench power supplies, and I actually went with another manager who was in another organization because he needed them too. He was kind of more on the hardware side, but obviously on the software side, we needed them as well. And so we're looking through and God, I don't even remember what it's just like with anything, right? There's the knee of the curve. Like where are you just spending money just to spend money on something versus, where is the reliable, the best reliable, where's the Honda Accord of bench power supplies, right? You don't need to. You don't need a Bentley.
Yeah, but I know you. That's less about the Apple mentality than you personally.
Maybe that's
you and I are a lot. You and I are a lot alike that way. So, because my managers had come to me with some like ridiculous thing, and I was like, choices. What's the gauge here? Do we need Chrome on this thing? Right? Louvers and stuff.
Take a quick break so I can tell you about lynda.com. lynda.com is an easy and affordable way to help individuals and organizations learn. Instantly stream thousands of courses created by experts on software, web development, graphic design, and more. So here's what I love about lynda.com. It is really the closest you can get to actually jacking into the web and downloading vast amounts of knowledge into your brain matrix. I remember once I was at a design shop. I was doing design for internet database stuff, which was not fun, but was challenging. And we switched from using Corel as our base software, because we're a Canadian company. We used Corel, nothing wrong with that, to using Adobe. And I had no idea. I had no idea how Illustrator worked. I had no idea how Photoshop worked. All I knew was Corel Draw, Corel Paint. And while they are similar programs, they did things in vastly different ways. And I just remember staring at that screen, not sure how to do, very basic things that I needed to do. But my company was luckily enlightened enough that they paid for lynda.com for me. And I got on there, and it was very different back then. This was a while ago, but the quality and the consistency and the enjoyability of the learning process was very much the same. I found the courses on the new versions of the software that I had on Photoshop and Illustrator. I watched them, and I very quickly got up to speed. I got up to speed far more quickly than I ever could have if I had had to tackle those alone. And one of the only constants in this business is change. There's new versions of software coming all the time. There's entirely new programs coming all the time. It will be something better. There will be something new. And you can either start getting afraid of it, or you can embrace it. And with lynda.com, you don't have to worry, because you're not in it alone. They're right there with you. They have all sorts of courses for developers, for designers, for people who just want to learn how to get more out of the software that they have. There's beginners, there's advanced, they have great tools. There's transcripts, playlists, certificates of course completion. You can learn on your computer. You can learn on the iPhone. You can learn on the iPad. You can learn on Android if that's what you want to do. Best of all, $25 gives you unlimited access to over 100,000 videos. The price has always been killer. You just get as much as you can for one small fee. That's why my company was willing to do it. They figured I would learn everything I needed to know, and it wouldn't cost them much money to do it. It's an investment. It's really not an expense. It's an investment. There's even premium plans if you want to upgrade to those. And just some of the stuff they have going on right now: managing your mobile photos, Google Docs and spreadsheets, iOS, First Look, iPad for Business, up and running. Get up and running with OpenGL. You do not have to be Guy English to do OpenGL. You can sit down with Lynda and learn it. So here's what I want you to do. I want you to go to lynda.com/debug and just try it for free for 7 days. Seriously, go there right now. Type into your browser as you are listening to these words, lynda.com/debug, and try it free for 7 days. There's got to be something that you want to get better at, that you want to learn, that you've always been interested in, whether it's for work, whether it's for hobby, whether it's just for fun. Give it a shot. Try it. lynda.com/debug. Your brain will thank you. You guys, Don, you did a whole episode of Vector talking about how you built the Safari team at Apple. But I thought it'd be interesting to talk a little bit about, we'll get in on the conversation about building teams, but also how you, because you got a lot of really smart people came out of the Safari team, a lot of smart people come out of Apple, but just how you you helped the people that you managed become successful.
Well, the thing that, and I think Nitin mentioned this the last episode on hiring people, is it you always want to hire people as much as you can that are smarter than you and that could replace you. You know, you want to hire really, really good people. And as a manager, you know, your job is to make sure they understand what they need to do, and get them the tools to do that job. And then as much as possible, get the fuck out of their way and let them do it. It's really, really simple. I mean, you know, you're a director, so direct, for Christ's sake, and make sure people understand what needs to be done. And I think that I was very fortunate. So many brilliant people I was able to hire, and they hired so many other brilliant people, and some of them, like people like Darren Adler, who's still at Apple running Safari and WebKit, took over for me. You know, he's turned his entire organization into essentially a teaching hospital, right? You know, kind of mentality. Like, let's, which is more brilliant than I ever did, certainly, you know, how to maximize mentoring in the organization. I was very proud of that, of his efforts to do that. But I saw brilliance all over the organization like that. For me, the thing that I miss most about Apple is the people, in two ways, just the friendships and being around them. But there's this odd thing, is the intimidation of being around all these brilliant people. Because I got to tell you, you're around that many smart people, it keeps you on your game like you wouldn't believe. I mean, there were just mutants there. You know what I mean, right, Nitin?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And that was one of the most...
You had some in your group.
Oh, yeah. I'm proud to say I hired a lot of those mutants. So, and as far as, you know, hiring kind of the early iPhone team and things like that, that's actually something that, Guy, I wanted to talk to you about, and I think that there might be kind of an interesting presentation there. So we should probably follow up on that, and maybe at a future conference.
Did Guy con you into going to Singleton or something? Or,
well, he tried to con me, and I was I
tried to pull a fast one. Yeah. So, but no, I think that's a great I think it's a great idea.
Yeah. So yeah, but I mean, let's see. All right, what was I going to say? There's so much there. As far as hiring people, or as far as managing people, for me, the thing that I always tried to do was just my own crappy imitation of the best managers that I ever had. And
that's a good way to do it. That description there, I actually gave that advice. In terms of, you know, how mentoring, you know, emulate somebody you know you like and you respect. What the hell?
Right. And for me, it was a guy named Tim Swihart. I'm not sure if you got to know him, but he led the early Intel effort, the Intel on Mac effort, not the early mid 90s one, but the one that actually shipped and
crusty and son of a gun, which explains a lot.
Right, exactly. But I worked for him during, you know, System 7, you know, from 7.5 whenever I started until I switched over to working for Scott Forstall. And the things that I admired so much about Tim were that, I mean, he really made it a priority to shield his people from any external bullshit. You know, and that was the first time that I sort of even realized that, oh, that's a thing that managers do is, if you're on a small team, and especially if you're on a small team where there are a lot of people who have their deliverables that are somehow tied into what you're doing as well, there are a lot of opportunities there for people to come in and sort of make one-off requests or one-off, ask for favors or things like that. And just you know, and it happened to us when we were on, when we were just a small ragtag team working on System 7.5. But later on, it turned into, I mean, and that was for under very different, obviously very different circumstances than when we had a relatively small team working on iPhone. But it was the solutions were, the problem was the same and the solutions were the same, which were, you know, which was just making sure that your people know that, you know, you're there for them and that you value their time as much as they value their time, if not more. And so anything that, that you can do to make it so that they're more productive. And if that means keeping them out of meetings with project managers who want something that's really unimportant or is not as important to you as it is to them, then maybe send a manager to a meeting instead. You know, managers are good for meetings and let engineers do engineering work. And a lot of those types of things were things that I learned under Tim, and that I sort of carried on later. The other thing that I really liked about Tim was, you would get this. I mean, he was just generally an optimistic guy, but he also had a little bit of a snarky side too. But because of that, I mean, you were never going to get this rose-colored picture about how things were going from him, right? You knew that even though, generally speaking, he was an optimistic person, and I think as a leader, I think it's important to have sort of that optimism as well. I mean, you know, ask your Ronald Reagans or your Barack Obamas or any, you know, anything like that, right? I mean, it's even at those levels of leadership, having some optimism is a very important thing. People want to hear an optimistic spin in some ways, but at the same time, you can't do it to the point where you're just insincere or where you're painting a bullshit picture, right? I mean, if there's shit, if shit is flying, you got to be honest with your team and you have to let them know that shit is flying and just give as much clear information. Well, and
I'm going to add an asterisk to that part when you're done, but yeah, I've got a story for that one too.
Oh yeah, exactly. But really there's this balance. I mean, ultimately, if you have to pick between optimistic and the truth, you always pick the truth, right? I mean, you always have to be sincere. You always have to be telling the truth and letting people know what's actually going on. Because if you don't do that, then sort of going through prioritizing or any of these other exercises becomes very difficult because people just don't believe you to begin with. So anyway, go ahead.
I agree with you on all that. And I got to agree. Swihart was quite the guy. He was a very trustworthy fellow when I dealt with him and just a character. I enjoyed just sitting around talking to him. I know that, you know, because I like to make things scatological. I used to say, you know, your job as a manager is to stand at the back end of the elephant, right? You know, take one for the team. You know, if you got to use an umbrella, a shovel or whatever, just keep it off the people who are actually doing the work. You know, your job is to keep that stuff away from them. Now, people will figure that out every once in a while because they'll get they'll see a taste of the craziness that goes on through a side door every once in a while. And I completely agree with you is that, you know, as much as possible, keep external forces off from distracting people and keep the little pieces of bullshit away from them.
So if you had to... Sorry,
but what I was going to say was in terms of letting them in on everything, there were times at Apple where I very specifically didn't let them in on what was going on. Certainly in the early days of the creation of Safari, it was like there seemed to be a crisis and was getting pulled one direction or the other quite often. And I would go to the meetings with the managers and deal with, you know, the varying different priorities between Scott, Bertrand, and Avi, who didn't always agree on these things. And I would come back and I wouldn't lie to them. I just wouldn't tell them about it because they didn't need to know how hard my job was or to worry about that shit, because that would just blow their confidence and distract them. Another great example was the ill-fated Safari on Windows project. We had hired a team. We had, I think, typical Apple fashion, you know, it's like a tiny team. I think we had four people. They were hard at work on Safari for Windows, and we were probably around 4 or 5 months away from delivery. And Darren Adler, who's, you know, one of my top lieutenants, and I went to a meeting, you know, the room, diplomacy, mm-hmm. with Steve, you know, with Scott, with Bertrand, you know, everybody. And Steve was having one of those days, and he killed it. He killed the whole project. Killed Safari for Windows that day. And we got out of there, and Darren is about just to go nuts. And it's like, oh my God, what do we do? What do we do? You know, what do we tell them? And I said, okay, we're going to stay here. This was in the lobby of IL2, or actually just right outside the door. We're going to go back to IL3, and we're not going to tell them anything. I said, because this is why, is like you weren't watching Forstall. I looked at his eyes, and I know what Scott's going to do after that crazy-ass meeting. He's going to go start working on Steve and talk him out of, you know, killing it. I'm going to give my boss a chance to do that. And even though it's dead, we're going to keep doing the work, and we're not going to tell him. But we're not going to lie to him, okay? We're just not going to tell. We're just going to leave out that part of the pass down, right?
Right.
And sure enough, a week later, Scott, as usual, pulls a miracle. Calls me up and says, you know, we're back on, get the team back on it. And I said, I'll get them started on it right away, sir. Because I wasn't going to tell them. I didn't kill it either.
It seems to me that you could have at least made the prudent argument, right? Like, well, we were never going to ship it, but we just kept working on it anyway because it's the right thing to do, right?
But if people don't need to know,
yes,
you don't tell it.
Yeah.
And I'm sad to say, when you have an organization of more than two people, shit like that's going to go down.
I think shit like that goes down inside a tight organization of two people.
Yeah, exactly. So that's part of your job, to make those hard decisions and to sweat the bullets for your team so that they don't get distracted by that horse shit.
Right. So that's now, part of... Okay.
After we shipped the fucking thing, I got them together and I told them that story.
Sure.
I told them what happened. Yeah. I said, I'm going to tell you what happens now. Right. And one of the smarter ones asked, Gramps, how often do you do that? And I said, you don't want to know now, do you? Yeah. But that's your job, and that's, you know, that's why they pay you the medium-sized bucks. And
yeah, well, I mean, you're an evening factor at that point, right? Like the
right.
The vagaries of the people that you're in charge with, the vagaries, the churn, I guess. I don't know. I'm trying to come up with the right word, but the elasticity, the randomness of the people below you. Your job is to present that as a cohesive whole to the people above you. Similarly, you have to filter their random stuff in order to present it to the people that you are managing.
Right.
And it's like a dampening factor.
Yeah, and I know. Yes. And I'm sure you've been in Scott's staff to cover for Henri several times. I know, because I was in the room with you, right? And you know how many times that Scott would go off and say, this is not for pass down. And then he'd spend, you know, 45 minutes talking about something that was not for pass down. Then Steve would call him out of the meeting, and that was it. And you'd go back to your people, and they'd say, what's the pass down? And you're thinking, I don't have dick.
Well, actually, and where I thought you were going with that was what I consider another form of bullshit that you shield your team from, which is, you know, that there are times when Scott would come in. Scott was never shy about letting you know what other people thought about the products you were working on. Right. Oh, yeah. So to give a specific example, you know, if let's say hypothetically that thought that some new feature of
hypothetically, you
know, the mail application on iPhone was a big steaming piece of shit and he's never had it work right for him. And he's wondering why we're even working on this, you know, on any of this functionality when we can't even get what he thinks is the simple part right. And he went off and Scott tried it too. And Scott thought it was a big piece of shit as well.
Theoretically.
Right? Hypothetically.
Yeah, hypothetically.
And by the way, that is hypothetical. There was not, I'm not thinking of a specific feature within mail, but this is the type of thing that right. would happen all the time. That's also the kind of thing that, okay, you can use that to adjust your own priorities and, hey, maybe let's
but you
look
don't,
at these bugs
you don't
on this
go
thing.
Back to your team and tell them that's what the exec said, right?
Exactly. Yeah. You do not go
you
back to your team and say that you guys should all be fired and you're all a bunch of idiots and how the hell did this ever even make it into a release that he got on his phone, right? they don't need to know that. That's the bullshit that needs shielding from, right? But exactly. Obviously you use that to adjust your priorities and maybe do a little bit of extra work on such and such feature or on the performance of app launch or what, you know, whatever it is, right? But yes, that I consider that also a form of that bullshit.
So yeah, and that kind of thing happened more often you would think. Some exec somewhere would, you know, have a bad hair day and get off on something and do a complaint about it. But the thing is, you had to get really circumspect about this kind of stuff. Sure, it's annoying that they get your boss's ear and then feed him a bunch of bile, which he likes to spread on you to, you know, ruin the taste of your lunch. But here's the thing about that. He was using your product, possibly in a prototype and in another way. And he or she, you know, was giving feedback. It may not have been the feedback that you liked, but a lot of times we mine this stuff to get really useful things out of it because some of the complaints were valid. I mean, and you have to take it the other way, as I explained to an engineer who unfortunately did get, because I sent in one of these hypothetical cases, I sent an engineer to go try to figure out exactly what was going on with the exec, and the exec just gave him, was stupidly in the room instead of their admin or something else, gave my engineer the earful. And so the same thing that I heard, which was unfortunate, I talked to him about that, and I said, you know, this is useful data. We can do something with this. And he cared about the product. He wants to make sure it's really good. So, hey, win all around.
I'll go one further.
But win all around.
Yeah, I'll go one further. The feedback was almost always very useful. I mean, I can't think of a time where it was, oh, you know, just configured his settings wrong or something like that, right? To me, that was all. That was a, oh, well, what the hell did we do in our UI that made it fell off the rails.
Exactly.
Right.
Perhaps, so, I mean, perhaps impolitic or impolite, but not mean spirited. Just
exactly. Or yeah, exactly.
Well, you know what I mean? Like it's helpful anyway, like regardless, filter out the way it's delivered and there's right. still like something good there. Right.
Exactly.
Because the thing you have to remember is that these executives were getting schooled on the knee of Steve Jobs, and Steve just didn't mince words.
Right.
And so they just assume that that's the way you do things. And yeah. I got to tell you that Tim Cook's the same way. You know,
is that part of the culture?
There's that fine, genteel Southern accent and humor and smile. But, you know, behind a closed door, you know, he's just as...
yeah, I don't get the sense.
Marvelously ruthless as Steve was. And that's a good thing. There's nothing wrong with that. That is a useful thing. And now, as a retired person and a shareholder, you know, that's going to keep the company in shape and on track.
Take a quick break so I can tell you about Backblaze. So Backblaze, what is it? In the simplest possible way, it's how you sleep at night. It's how you sleep at night knowing that all of your data is backed up offsite and available to you if you need it. Now, nobody wants the worst. No one expects to have their computer fail, to have something happen to their office or their home, to be left without access to the stuff that is most important to you. But you really have to plan for that eventuality. Bad things happen to good drives. And we want to make sure that all the data we care about, whether it's our precious family photos or whether it's a big project that we're working on, are safe and secure. So that's why you've got to have a backup strategy. You've got to have local backups, whether it's Time Machine or Super Duper. And you've got to have offsite backups. And the simplest, easiest way to do that is Backblaze. It backs up all the data on your computer and it makes all of it accessible online. They have hundreds of petabyte. That is a number so big, it sounds ludicrously made up, but it is in fact a real number. They've just crossed the 7 billion mark for the number of files restored. The best thing about Backblaze is, yes, if you lose a drive, you can get all that data back. But even if you just leave the house and you need access to a file and you didn't copy it somewhere, it is backed up to Backblaze. You can use their app on their mobile app. You can just go there. You can get that file. You can save that presentation. You can save that trip. You can get what you need when and where you need it. There's no add-ons. There's no gimmicks. There's no additional charges. Just go to backblaze.com/debug and get your free trial. And when you're happy with it, and I know you will be happy with it, it's just $5 a month per computer for unlimited, unthrottled backup for all your data. And not just the data on your machine. If you have external drives, that data too. It really is $5 per computer per month. That is a ridiculously low price for peace of mind, for the ability to sleep at night, for the ability to know that everything that is important to you is safe and taken care of and there for you if you should ever need it. So absolutely hope for the best, but plan for the worst. Make sure that you have a backup strategy. And I cannot recommend Backblaze anymore as part of that strategy. So again, get a risk-free, no credit card required, full-featured trial, backblaze.com/debug. Seriously, go now. I'm backing up this podcast as we speak.
Has that notion of being decisive and communicating...
Having high standards, certainly.
Well, high standards, for sure. But the way that you communicate those standards to your... reports, is that commonly done in
bluntness? Yes, bluntness is pretty
blunt is a better word. Yeah,
yeah, bluntness is civil. So,
but was that true in your group
at all? What?
Hello.
Hey, was that true in your group too? Like a very direct, sort of blunt, no nonsense communication with issues or saying what you needed fixed.
You mean with my own managers?
I guess, yeah. I mean, yeah, you had managers who reported to you. How did you tell them what to do?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think, you may want to ask them instead of me.
I will. Stop. Actually know
we're,
some.
We're terrible people to actually know ask some, that question.
So I will. Yeah.
Exactly. I tried to really, for me, some of that actually, it felt a little bit like an indulgence. And so, rather than sort of letting that kind of take place in my own staff meetings, I really tried to just sort of stick to the facts. And, if somebody just got completely reamed out about something, then, let them know that this is what happened. Or, every now and then maybe conversations would get a little bit heated, but by and large, I really try out of my own staff meeting with my managers. Now I wouldn't hide, if hypothetically thought that iMessage was hypothetically a big piece of shit, I wouldn't hide that, and I would let my manager, who is responsible for iMessage, know that. But I would also expect, and fortunately, I also knew that my manager was smart enough to know to not just pass that down just completely unfiltered as well.
Right.
I mean, really, it was to give as much context to my own managers as possible. But but just kind of going off in a meeting and this flipping the table stuff and whatever, I've certainly been guilty of it in the past, but I really see it as more of an indulgence and really just not necessary to get things done. And so I just didn't.
Yeah. I get the feelings. I think some people who maybe this is not even an Apple, this is just a general management observation. I think some people hear about this kind of stuff and adopt just literally being an asshole and like table flipping stuff as an affectation. Like they're not even actually that angry. They just act out because they think that's going to get results.
I had a manager at Sun Microsystems who did that kind of thing. And he would get angry because he thought that was the... He would affect stuff like that. And you just never want to do that with people because it's not...
I don't think you can be...
There's not a lot
genuine,
of truth
right?
to it, right? Right.
Yeah.
You don't want to affect something like that. Now, I did tell people, you know, the whole... Gramps character that I played at work. I wasn't necessarily that character everywhere else. You know, the curmudgeon, you know, kind of guy. And
you know, after the first show you were on, I had people tell me they were scared of you in the halls. I love that. It was awesome.
Yeah. You passed that back to me. I was like, really? The hell was I doing
see
that
it.
Joke?
Well, I mean, you know, possible
but
to see.
But that's what
it,
I mean
just
is
made
like,
me laugh. Yeah,
Nitin and I, you know, like I don't know in some ways how my managers regarded me directly, but I know in my own staff meetings I let them get away with a lot and let them yell at me about stuff right. with their peers. You know, the five or six of us in there complain about things, and then it was like a cleansing breath when we left, and I didn't pass that information on because I wanted as much as possible their feedback about what was really frustrating them. Yeah.
And
especially
if you're going to be working those kind of hours too. Right?
Yeah. Well, you need that kind of catharsis, but it's also a way to test what's really bullshit and not. Right. Like if only one person was complaining about something, but not everybody else was, it was useless. And the thing is, if you're going to be a manager and you're going to work at a place like Apple with those radioactive personalities, you develop a real thick skin after a while. This is not for shy people, wallflowers, or the easily offended, right?
There's a headline.
Yeah, there's another. Yeah,
we need a bell every time. Headline.
Fuck
Apple, not for the easily offended.
Yeah, and I don't mean in the politically correct kind of way. I'm very proud of Apple. When Tim Cook a couple of months ago released the hiring report about where they're at with diversity. Yeah, it's
I like his wording on that too.
Damn, I'm proud of that company that they are trying. And there were a lot of strife. Didn't you remember what a maniac Forsall was about diversity, right?
Oh, absolutely. Well, and that was the thing was, I think that my team probably certainly not for 1.0. By the time we got to 3.0. I think that we were, Scott one time actually came by and said he was happy to see, how relatively diverse my organization was compared to others. But
it
really,
you made a conscious effort in doing that, in achieving
well,
it, I should say?
Somewhat, not really. I mean, I always just wanted to hire the absolute best people. But you know, the thing is that, I was still not very proud of the fact that, I think even at its height, I think I had between 15% and 20% female engineers. Mm-hmm. That was better than a lot of the other groups that Forsall was managing. But it's still, it's just pathetic, right? I mean,
that's,
if you think about
super smart people though, because I know a few of those women in there.
Oh, absolutely,
a little bit brainiac level. Yeah.
They're mutants. Of course, right?
Well, the key thing that we learned as managers. And one of the things I passed back up the chain to Scott, because he was asking me, because he was saying that my group was making some improvements. And I was like, oh, really? reaction at first. And I think, Renee, we talked on this on the show, is one of the things I just stumbled on by dumb luck at Apple, because I was just trying to find a warm body to do the hard job of going through resumes, is that, if you start having people that are not WASPs, not straight boring ass wasps like myself go through the resumes, you'd be surprised at, you know, how much diversity you get in terms of candidate.
A smart move, like have a woman do it or have a
Adele Peterson was one of the people who embraced that. She's now running Mobile Safari. Adele Peterson, early on said, I'll do that. And we got a lot more female candidates. And, Red Dutta over on the calendar team jumped in to try to help hiring. And we got a lot more ethnic diversity with in terms of candidates with him in there. So, and the nice thing is that breeds more and more after a while. And it's not that they were selecting these over other people. What they were doing was they were looking at other wells. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
Well, I think whatever weird innate.
Yeah. Whatever.
I don't
want
to say prejudice, tribalism. But like, that's gone.
Yeah.
Or at least it's in a different bucket, right? So, here's one thing I think: gender diversity. You can sort of peg on the name, effectively. I don't know how you can use, like, how do you use names to pick?
Just looking at resumes. It's like
a cultural diversity, right?
Well, no, a lot of these people are going out to the schools, they're going out to other things and interviewing candidates.
Oh, okay. That's
right.
Totally different.
And so
thinking of a stack of paper, which.
Right. You're right. And I'm sorry if I use that analogy, but there's two things that happens when you send out more diverse people is that one, you have like a whole different set of eyes to look at the candidates, but you get more diverse candidates because they're willing to go and talk to the person that represents the company.
That's a great point. It's very subtle.
Yeah. It's very subtle. It's very important. So, you know.
Well, in a sea of tables at a job fair, I mean, it's not a job fair per se, but you know what I mean?
It's exactly
that. Why would you not just go up to the guy that you, or the woman that you.
That you identify with,
you know?
Like, it is so important to do that. And like I said, you know, Apple's not where they want to be. They recognize that. But they're out there swinging, right?
Well,
they're trying to make it better.
I think the fact that it's talked about and like, you know, we're talking about it, this came up completely organically too. It's not in the notes to discuss. I think that says something. I think it's interesting. Yeah. I think we'll see, depending on the deltas, right, of these reports, we'll see if anything's actually changing. Like if it's just static and people keep across the industry, I don't just mean Apple here, but if people keep putting up these diversity reports and effectively there's no change, then the point of doing the reports is just completely lost. It's effectively.
No. The point of doing the reports is still useful because it says we're doing something wrong. There's no change.
Yes.
We've got to get off our asses.
Yeah. But if you stop, if you put up, so the film industry has done this for years. They've got like 10, almost 15 years of backlog of like, there are no women writers and we're very few, I should say. And it hasn't changed statistically and they haven't done anything to make it change. So they just kind of do these reports.
See, that's what I was going to say was, I mean, I'm glad that it's being measured. I mean, you manage what you measure in some ways, but at the same time, I think that culture and prejudices are one of those aspects of human behavior that change so much more slowly than anything else. Mm-hmm. Honestly, I'm a tiny bit pessimistic over how fast things are going to change now that a company like Apple is actually putting these numbers out.
Agreed.
There. I think it was Brianna who posted something on Twitter saying, you know, look at the here is an article or here's a post from 1999 on some gaming magazine, right. You know, it's talking about how, you know, women are underrepresented in games and look how little has changed since then. Right. I mean, that's the kind of thing. And your film example is another very good one. So, I mean, I think that humans are very good at adapting to things that, you know, either save them money or save them time.
Or effort.
But when it comes to, you know, sort of their base prejudices and sort of cultural kind of upbringing and things like that. I think those are the things that take a very, very long amount of time.
And, I like the idea of being inclusive in the hiring process will lead you to be more inclusive in the job. I think those are the kind of positive steps that make an impact.
Right. Okay.
Right. Right. Exactly. But you know, I think the other thing too is we need people out there who are those models, right? We need the Grace Hoppers and the Ada Lovelace and those, but we need the modern day versions of those. But
she did Springboard. It's fine.
Yeah, I'm a little more.
And just doing Springboard and having to deal with that damn code is going to make her a better person or a serial killer.
That's the Springboard code.
So. Yeah. Well, Springboard was one of I always heard from my friends, one of the gnarliest pieces of code on top level iOS.
My understanding is being queued up, but
here's the thing about Springboard: the team desperately wanted to refactor it for years, but they kept having to put other features in it and make it even nuttier. So everybody who worked on it knew how skanky it was for a while, and I think it was really iOS 6. They finally got a crack at doing some cleanup, right? But it took that long.
It was around iOS 6. I believe so. I wasn't there for shipping iOS 6. But certainly, and even before iOS 6, there were, around the iOS 3.0 timeframe, believe it or not, there was a lot of work that went into cleaning up Springboard as well. But it was poorly conceived of and done.
It's just it happened to be the Windows Server and the launcher and
it's the Windows thing. Server login window, and it's the other half of UIKit, right? It's also so it does a lot. I know that's a shitty excuse too, but there's a lot going on there. Right.
And the thing is. I respected everybody that worked on it because it was a really tough job because they also got jerked around a lot, and they had to. This is the worst thing about using a top level thing. I used to lament this with Pavel Sizler, who was the manager of the Finder on OS X. I mean, just a lot of bugs just came in straight to him that were not Finder bugs. There were bugs for for John Yoroch's team, who John was very glad to handle the stuff. There were bugs for other teams and things like that. Hell, there were Safari bugs that would come into Pavel. So when you're the face of the operating system, you're like leaning into a punch, man. That's a tough job.
Well, and as iOS apps, manager, I mean, I can certainly speak to that in spades, right? But it's kind of like the analogy that I always used was it's like a house, right? I mean, you're not going to notice when the framing for a given room is wrong, right? You're not going to notice when the framing is incorrect or it's, not been measured or there, things aren't perfectly square. You're going to notice it when there's a wall that's all fucked up looking or, when you try to put in an outlet and you can't square the outlet with two, because you're working with two non-perpendicular.
You're yelling at the paint and drywall when you should be yelling at the wood inside.
Exactly. Yeah. And unfortunately that's not very satisfying to an apps engineer or an apps manager. at those moments when somebody's saying, "What the fuck is wrong with this outlet? I can't get this thing." What's wrong with this thing? There's a bug in the outlet, right? Maybe it's not actually the outlet. Maybe there's something underneath that's going on, right? But I mean, that's part of the deal too, right? Hey, if you want the glory of being able to say that, hey, look, you see this thing that you launched and that you use every day and that you interact directly with every day, I wrote that code, right? That's the upside, right? Mm-hmm. Because believe me, the file system person or the person people who work on the virtual memory system, they don't get to say that. And I can say that firsthand because I work on file systems.
Right.
Right?
Yep.
You can, so good luck explaining that to your, to your uncle, what the hell you do. It's not going to help. But if you can actually point to an app and say, hey, look, you see that thing that you load web pages on every day? I wrote that or I worked on that thing. Right. Yep. That's the, you take the good with the bad. And so, that's just the nature of the beast.
Every day people type angry comments to Don in the software that he helped bring into the world.
Oh yeah.
Thanks,
it's a double-edged,
Don.
Yeah, it's oh, a double-edged yeah. sort of visibility.
Well, right? You know,
exactly.
This goes back to the, you know, how we opened this broadcast about the reaction to the last broadcast and the whole complaining thing. You know, why I don't complain about that thing. I mean, Jesus, I got the chance to change the world, and I did. How many times does anybody get to do that? I mean, you lucky son of a bitch. I am, you know, so I'm just delighted to have that job, you know, and it's not, here's the other thing. It's not like I didn't know it was hard. It's not like I did any of that stuff unwillingly.
Well, you know, I mean, what I was going to say at the time, like at the top of the show, but you guys were rolling too hard.
sorry, guy.
No, it's good. I think I would bet that there were people working at BlackBerry on BB10, like their new OS, that were doing crazy hours and totally busting their asses. Nobody's going to write a story about them on or do a bit on them on CNBC.
How many startups are there where the people don't see their families for years at a time?
Well, startups are a different plague on the earth, but there's a well, lot yeah, of people but, in a lot but, of jobs doing a lot of stuff that you don't get to hear about.
My father was an early IBM engineer, and I barely saw him when I was growing up.
Yeah, I bet. But, yeah, it's
but
not
terrific.
Uncommon.
But Renee said that there's a lot of people who work at startups who've given their heart and soul. And
oh yeah,
fails.
I don't mean to. I don't. Yes, yeah. I'm sorry. I don't mean to diminish anybody's work in a startup. I just think that is a different.
Yes.
That's a different thing from the process of Apple. And,
I think it's like my only comment on this is that, you know, you have people have passions, and I work, you know, my friends tell me I work hours that are clinically insane.
Yeah,
but
you're
I love
an idiot.
What
no,
I do.
They don't just tell you that. That's
no,
what
but
you
I think
do.
It's like, when I listen to you, what I got was passion and love of craft and wanting to make something that made a difference. And I think whether it's a hobby or a job or your family, everybody has those things. And if you can do that, like, it's not that you're having to work those hours. It's that you're pouring yourself into what you're doing.
Right.
And it's that passion that fondness for the craft and the wanting to make a difference, exactly what you said, that kept a lot of us going and doing those crazy things. And I see that at, you know, certainly at Apple still. If I ever, you know, did a little peekaboo inside and didn't say that anymore, well, I'd sure as shit sell all my stock. But that's the way it is there now. And that's why that culture is not going to change. It's not like Scott put a gun to my head and said, you will do all this stuff for me and be at my beck and call. Here's what I would say to Scott. And he always said he really appreciated. I always said, what do you need? Can I do more to help? Is there something my team can be doing right now to help us through this crisis that I'm too stupid to see? What else can we do here? Because that's what you do. That's your fucking job. It's a team. It's you're all in this together, right? That's why I stepped in to help Henri out with the iPad. And that's why I said, okay, Henri, we're through this crisis. Here you go. There's the coolness back. And some of my team members hated that, but that was the right thing to do. You know, you take one for the team that way. And I was glad to do that. I mean, why wouldn't I? We got to have that huge impact. We got to do all these cool things. And the other thing is I sometimes I make it sound like, you know, Scott's some like arbitrary ogre. He was not. He always had my back. And I learned so much from him. He was just a very intense guy, right?
I don't think you try to
do that job and not be an intense guy. I mean,
I don't think Scott Forstall has ever come up on this show without somebody being like praising him. And I think that's probably for a good reason.
Yeah.
I'm just hearing the in my mind, I'm just playing the CNBC article title, which is Scott was an ogre. Scott was an arbitrary ogre.
And you know,
tabloids around the world, here's your clickbait headline. Scott Forstall, arbitrary ogre? Question mark?
Exactly.
Oh, God.
So you're done. Take that one to the bank.
Take that one to the bank, yeah.
Jerks.
Yeah. No, you know, and people ask me, always want me to chime in on the Tim versus Scott thing and whatever. And I'll hopefully, Nitin, you say the same thing I do. It's like, shit, I wasn't there. I don't know what's going on. Mm-hmm. You know, Tim, I worked for Scott. He was a great guy. I knew Tim. I didn't work for him directly. He was a great guy. What the hell? Why are you asking me?
We have a problem, and it goes back to what we were talking about before. There's a problem in our world where we don't think that two things can both be true or two things can both be accurate, or that you can have to make a choice between, like, you could still have two great options and still have to make a choice between them. We always want to cast one as good and one as bad and make everything sort of a competition or an enemy situation, and I think we're lesser for it sometimes.
I think Star Wars did that to us, Renee.
Don't blame Star Wars for anything.
I'm just making a joke. Get I'm just making a joke because of the tweet I did this morning about your iPhone reviews. So. I thought we were fantastic and also hysterical.
Thank you. But again, like, I was up till 5 a.m. three nights in a row working on those, and I have nothing but joy in my heart that I did them.
Oh yeah, I sent them to Alice, who's still on the edge about which iPhone she wants. So.
You want the one as big as a Apple pancake.
Well, you know, she told me today on the walk with Buddy that she's thinking about getting a smaller one because she doesn't think she can fit the other one in her her pockets, and she's worried about that. I was like, oh God, you know. So, but tomorrow it'll change. It'll be the plus. So,
I think the 6 is even too big for me.
Wow. You know, the thing that I realized today,
and I literally, I'm sorry, like, reachability, that's a hack. Sorry. I'm just.
Oh, it is a hack. It's a glorious hack. I think it's a.
It's a hack. That's gross. I don't need
to do that. I think it's a better hack than the one that Samsung came up with to solve that problem,
yeah,
which is also a pretty good hack.
That's incredibly high praise. It's a better hack than what Samsung did. That's good. Good job.
But I've seen the videos and stuff. It seems like it would work.
Did you get a new phone, Don?
It works.
No, not yet. I don't buy Rev 8 boards. So.
I used to have that policy. Anyway, sorry. Neaton.
Not yet. Not yet, only because I want a 6 Plus. And, well, the problem I have right now is, I don't know if I mentioned this, I'm a cheap guy, but and my 5S is perfect. It's in perfect condition. So I'm kind of like, well, I really want the 6 Plus. I really want that. You know, and I hate the word phablet, but I want that 5.5 inch screen. But I agree that reachability is just it's a hack. I'm sure that there was lots of. By the way, I'm sure that there were so many different experiments that were tried internally, and so I imagine that this was tried to the hilt, and that there were reasons why it just didn't work or wasn't good enough. But what I really wanted to see was there are ways with this touch technology to actually detect if somebody's, you know, not only if somebody's finger is trying to hit something on some part of the screen, but if there's something else that's being touched as well, right? So, in other words, if the flesh of your palm is touching the right edge of your screen, let's say you're holding the phone in your right hand, and if the flesh of your palm or you know, underneath your thumb happens to hit the screen, you know, on the right side or somewhere. Yet at the same time, there's a touch that's coming in from something that looks a hell of a lot more like a finger or a thumb. Then throw away the other stuff and just use the, you know, use the touch pattern. Just treat it as though the thumb touched the screen instead. So in other words, make it a little bit more forgiving and make it so that, you know, if you are really reaching and you have to kind of straddle your hand and kind of move over, that it's still going to work. It's still going to do what you mean. Right.
Yeah. I think that's a good point. So I don't know if people at home know, but the touch technology is less of a binary, like you touched here kind of thing. It's a field with a probability of how close, it's a magnetic field, a few millimeters. I don't know what the range is above the actual plate. Right.
Yes.
Right. Yeah. And so you, when you touch, like quote unquote touch, it's that it's just that the software has determined that there's a high probability that this is, it's the closest point of effectively a cloud of magnetic imaging.
And you know, and really a good way to sort of drive this home is if you've ever, you know, when you touch, this is some, one of the things that we learned very early on was when a user touches on the, touches the screen on the display, they're actually touching much lower than they think they are.
Right.
Because the fleshy part of your thumb or your finger makes contact at a point that's farther down on your finger or your thumb than where the point of your finger or your thumb is, right? And so that's all taken into consideration. And there's this well, it used to be sort of this, you know, this projection of of the touch points to really determine what you actually meant to touch.
Yeah.
Right.
I Which mean, is probably calibrated to by the orientation too, right?
Yeah, well, yes, exactly. And the really the way that this shows up is if you've ever tried to give somebody a demo of an app or something like that on the iPhone, and you've held the iPhone upside down, and you're trying to touch on the iPhone to show them how you navigate through something, you'll understand very quickly you have to touch much lower. You know, you have to consciously touch much lower on the screen than you actually expect.
It's
you
why
would.
Those robot tests kept having a hard time with touch accuracy on the iPhone. They were all doing everything from straight up and down.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. So, yeah, so it's really, well, and for me, that was really one of the things that was so fascinating about this technology in general was just, you know, it's sort of this mix of the, you know, the organic fleshy meatiness of,
right.
of humans, you know, coming physically, literally into contact with the digital world. And
yeah, it's
right. And you don't really ever have this with a, you know, this kind of subtly with a keyboard and mouse. We started to on desktop computers when Apple thankfully added the touchpad, and there were a lot of heuristics that we learned from iOS that went into that. But this whole idea of being able to figure things out and conflicting inputs on the screen, as iOS has evolved, this has gotten better and better. But here's the thing, to get back to your point, Guy, about the problems is like, I have a real distinct advantage of using one of these phablets is like, I'm a complete spastic. So I have to use two hands to type anyway. So I don't give a shit.
Well, right? You're also
I can't type worth a
man.
Goddamn with, you know, with
you're,
one
you're
hand.
You're not a small guy though, right? You're like 8'6" or something.
No. Well, I'm a hair tall. Well, no. I got these tiny hands, these little girl hands, right?
Okay.
So, you know, my hands aren't big, but I'm just, you know, a spaz. So I've always used whenever you identify a tweet that I've written or you've seen sent from my iPhone from an email, you can bet damn sure I didn't type that with one hand because I just don't do that. I'm a two thumbs typer on the.
To me, it's the close button or the done button in the upper right hand corner.
Okay.
Which is like that happens a lot, and I just simply can't reach it.
The back button, upper left.
Upper left is a little easier to reach. It's the. I mean, literally that far diagonal.
It's
a commit action, right?
Or
a
see, all like this is overruled by the size of the screen because, like, say I'll be, how the fuck old will I be? I think I'll be 57, 58. Ah, fuck, I forget. At the end of the year, really old. Yeah, day over 80. Asshole. I just need the bigger screen. For God's sakes, please just give me the bigger screen. I don't care if it's higher resolution. Just give me the bigger screen. Because it's getting hard. I'm just so farsighted. It's getting hard to, you know, see what's even with these high powered bottle cap glasses of mine to get. Close to the phone to see it. So a bigger screen is really helpful.
That's a great point. Yeah.
Yeah. So I don't care about the size. And plus, you know, like I said, the last show, I wear styles from the 90s. I'm wearing cargo pants right now. It's not like I don't have the fucking pockets for an iPhone 6 Plus. So, you know, not an issue with me. As far as I'm concerned, Apple designed this phone just for me.
That's great, though. I mean, if a lot of people think that, perfect.
I was using one at lunch today, and Guy accused me of hogging the table when I put it down.
it's a pretty huge freaking phone, dude.
Well, my son asked me.
Blinked out in gold too.
Yeah, my son asked me because he desperately wants an iPhone 6 Plus, but he doesn't want it like gouging him in the leg when he puts it in his pocket. He said, but Dad, won't you look, you know, feel stupid holding that big ass thing up to your head? And I said, you've seen the way I look and dress, you know, the fact that I have no self-respect, what the hell would that matter to me? You know, it's like that,
I like,
you know,
this-
I'm sure people think I'm a douchebag for other reasons. If they thought it was a douchebag because I had a big ass phone, I don't care.
I like the split view controller on landscape.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. I've actually had, all right, so I'm going to admit something here. I've actually had
truth or dare.
I've not only played with Android phones for a long time, just because that was part of my job at Apple, yeah. but since I've left, I've had a Nexus 4, and now I have a Nexus 5 kind of as my second phone. And, you know, and you're absolutely right. I mean, you end up doing these silly things, right? Where you're kind of like, you have to kind of walk your hand up the side and walk your hand down the side to kind of touch everything. Mm-hmm. And pretty quickly you kind of just get to the point where you're like, ah, screw it. I'm just going to use my second, you know, my second hand to do what I need to do. But really it's because I've had this Nexus 5 and I've, you know, and I just love loading web pages on this thing. And I love, you know, if I'm looking at YouTube videos or anything like that, you know, or looking at I don't look at photos so much on my Nexus 5 because the camera is trash and the photo is garbage. Photos app is garbage too. But I imagine that looking at photos would be just as rewarding on a bigger screen. I just want that bigger screen and I just want bigger hit points. You know, that's what's in it for me. And I'm willing to do the walk up the side, you know, walk it up and down my hand or, you know, walk my hand up and down the device, or just use two hands to use it. And, you know, and I think for people with smaller hands and, you know, and maybe that's a lot more women, they've already had to do this anyway. Right. And so it's no loss, to say that, oh, you have to use two hands.
Well, that's starting with the 5. I think the original phone, to me, I love that. That, what is it, 3.5 inch? That, it's great.
The iPhone Nano.
So, yeah, I love that device.
Thank you, Renee.
I love the
that's
size
the
of it.
Writer in you being clever again. Thank you.
I think it's a very clever, very amazingly well-designed and well-thought-out physical shape of a device. Because I imagine Needham would know for sure, but I imagine a bigger device was on the table originally, and you shrunk it down to be this thing.
The tablet was on the.
Well, yeah, I don't mean the tablet. I mean, like, when you actually, like, hey, let's make a phone, I'm pretty sure you didn't just go with, okay, this is it. There's no other, nothing else on the table.
For some of the engineers in the beginning, it was a. It was an iMac G3 that was on the table. So,
no. Yeah. I mean, I understand that point of it, but
like
when
trying
you,
multiple sizes.
Exactly. When the hardware guys were like, "Yeah, what size do we make the phone?" Right?
Yeah, but, there was some of that, but you know, actually, at the
size
time,
was
the
pretty,
time was the size was considered huge. The size was actually at that time it was considered very big too, right? I mean, you look back at that original iPhone screen at that time. I mean, we were comparing it to what you see on an iPod. And it was very well understood back then that far and away the biggest things that just gobble up batteries are battery life are keeping the screen lit and radios.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, that was true then. It's true now. Physics.
Well, that's just physics. It's like, I mean, do you want to emit something into the world? Guess what? You're going to have to pay for it with energy, right?
Exactly. Yeah. So back then,
getting to the size of
so back then it was a huge screen. That's interesting.
My trio was 320 by 320 and tiny.
I hadn't thought of it like that. Like you built the biggest phone you could.
Well, there were a lot of breadboard prototypes just to try stuff out, but none of them were. This is what Steve's saying: the shape and size of the iPhone are going to be. When it got to that point, that got settled out in fairly short order, as I recall.
It was very short. I mean, so Tony Fadell was hardware managing the hardware effort at that time. And I think that even then it was sort of considered, the original iPhone screen was considered as big as we could possibly go and still hit these other metrics that we wanted to hit.
That's an interesting, that I hadn't thought of it that way. I really hadn't.
Yeah. Now I'd love to hear, you know, if there was some hard, you know, like, well, I was going to say Mike Culbert, you know, somebody like that, who's no
Where
longer
Culbert
with us.
Where is Culbert these days?
He passed away.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
My bad.
So yeah, I'm sure that there were some people, you know, who might know that there were other things that were being considered at the time, but right. pretty much as soon as, you know, very early on and it was very locked down that was the size of the screen and it was considered nice and big at that time too. Yep.
When I saw it, I was like blown away. Now that you lay that out, it makes a lot of sense that, yeah, you basically did make the biggest phone you could, right? So.
Yeah.
Those phones that Steve put up on the screen when he did the announcement were pretty typical, like, for popular phones. And they
those tiny little, one-and-a-half-inch square little screens, yeah.
Like the Palm. Well,
like, yellow and black.
He was doing that for contrast, too, so.
Well, but it's true. I mean, like, there were, like, Palm Pilots that I think there was one Palm Pilot that had a vertical screen, and there was, like, the LG Prada that had a large screen, but very.
Didn't they call so?
Some of the HTCs did, those were side, you know, with the keyboard folded out of the side like this, like the Sidekick.
Like the Danger device, yeah. Right.
Well, that was a bit of a standout device, right? Like
yeah.
that was...
Yeah. yeah.
But a big colorful screen like that was not...
Yeah. All right, let's wrap this up before we do 5 hours.
Well, this is actually short. We've only went an hour and a half here. I'm amazed.
I know.
So.
I felt we did this concisely.
I actually wanted to bring up one thing really quick, and
God
I thought
damn
that,
it, Needham.
Sorry. So my son.
Sorry. Wait, shoot.
Is that okay? All right.
Of course it's okay.
All right.
Run with it.
My son, and this was like related more to the native apps versus web apps thing. But I thought that it tied in interestingly, which was, okay, so my eldest son, and I happen to be of the opinion that these little kids, these kids nowadays, they shouldn't have electronics, they shouldn't have access to, you know, these light up screens and just be able to carry them around. When they're in elementary school, right? I mean, I just think that that's just too young, and that's just how we've kind of run our household and things like that. There's a limited time that you're allowed to have access to, you know, the light up screens, and you're not going to be one of those freaking kids who's like, you know, at the dinner table just looking at a screen that's just lit up in front of them and not participating in the conversation. So we've very deliberately kept that policy in place.
Wasn't there an article recently saying that Steve did the same thing?
Yeah, I was so happy to see that. It was Steve and other execs, it seemed like, were doing that too. And I always kind of felt like a fuddy-duddy for doing it, but there was a little bit of vindication as well when I saw that article.
What's funny is that we with my son, we didn't allow that kind of thing at the table. But now that, you know, he's older, I'm retired, it's mostly just me and my wife around. We'll both sit at the table looking at our phones or
like
laptops or something.
Right?
Yeah, what the hell?
It's like a
newspaper. So
it totally is a do as I say, not as I do thing. I'm a gigantic hypocrite, and I'm comfortable with that. As a parent, I'm okay with that. That's fine with me.
Right. But,
so recently, my son just got he went into middle school. He's walking further. He's away from the house a little, you know, longer during the day. So we decided, okay, it's time for him to have a phone. So he got a, you know, at this point, like I may have mentioned, I'm cheap. So he has set up one of my wife's old iPhone 4Ss. That's his phone for now, is an iPhone 4S. He loses shit all the time. He drops stuff in the toilet. He does all this kind of stuff. I'm not going to put a nickel towards the phone that he's going to own until he proves to me that he can actually have it, you know, own it and take care of it. So that's why it's a 4S. But the interesting thing is, so he's gone through
and
set it up.
You know, the phone I use now is a 4S.
Well, for the same reason. Alice has the exact same reason. No.
Yeah, when you stop dropping
she has
the
a 4.
Toilet, Don. Wow, that's it. Okay, that's another CNBC headline, I think, yeah. Right there. But so the interesting thing that I found with him, and my younger son did the same thing with the iPod Touch that he occasionally gets to use, like, usually when he's traveling, this is when he gets to use the iPod Touch. But it's the weirdest thing. So my eldest son, he set up his phone the way he wanted to. The browser, Safari, is not only is it not on the first page, It's in a folder on the second page.
You're just being mean now.
No,
Jesus Christ.
Don, I'm saying this because I whacked him in the back of the head. I was like, what are you saying? What are you doing here with the browser? You can't have a browser on, you know, the second screen in a folder. What's the matter with you? You know, you got to put this thing on the front page.
But
it was very interesting. It was very interesting to see that.
So does he not surf the web on his phone?
Apparently he doesn't surf the web.
There's apps for that.
Well, there's Snapchat is on the first page. That's for sure. There's iMessage, there's Google Hangouts. For him, there's like in YouTube and there's, you know, other things like that. You know, there's a bunch of different apps, but it was so weird to me that the browser was on the second page. And I'm wondering, I'd love to hear your thoughts. I'm not trying to someday.
No.
People are not going to use phones either. So,
I have had people come up to me on the, on the outside and, you know, curse me for what I've done for so many years that it just rolls over me like a gentle wave. I mean, I've had my sister, you know, I had a hand in, you know, helping the direction of the web and web standards a certain way. I've had my sister scream at me about CSS. Trust me, I can take it. So, but this is, I've met other people like this who just, they don't surf on their phones. Now, the funny thing is if your son has an iPad, I'd be curious if he does the same thing and moves Safari off, because what I find myself, I don't use, and part of it is because I have a fucking 4S and it's a tiny screen. I mean, I was sitting in the parking lot of Trader Joe's today, using Safari on my 4S, going to the Home Depot website of all things, looking for something that my wife told me about on the phone. And it is, thank God they have a mobile Safari friendly site and you can use it, but it is a bit of a chore to, you know, scroll around the page and stuff like that on a device that's that size. Adele's team has done marvelous things, you know, for my ancient 4S to make it usable. But I can see why people don't go to Safari first on the phone for certain things. And he has more specialized activities. He's not surfing the internet because you have a computer for him at home, right?
He has a computer. And anytime I've seen the screen on that, it is all Safari, right?
Yeah,
it's Safari
exactly.
And a bunch of tabs.
And the reason why I say this is my son all over. He never launches Safari on his phone, but he's always got it open on his desktop. And, you know, I asked him about this and he said, why do I want to surf the web on a phone? It's too small. and that was part of the joke about getting an iPhone 6 Plus for him for Christmas is like, you know, I'll finally, you know, use your browser, Dad, on the phone because enough. It's just because he does the same thing. He's using his little apps to communicate to his friends. That's what they're doing. He's not using it as a general purpose computing device. The other thing I find out, not to crush you, is he doesn't really use mail on his phone either.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
a total tit for tat move there.
Oh, so it's
it's really, right? Yeah, your son's the same way, right? But I'm sure he's got mail.app open on his desktop all the time, right?
Now that you mention it, he doesn't. He has a tab and he uses iCloud Mail in a tab. He doesn't even use the native mail app on his desktop.
Now that I come to think of my son, I don't know. I'm not sure if he's actually using mail.app or
is
he using
iMessage,
Gmail.
Though. That's the new email.
Oh, they all use iMessage.
Oh, yeah.
All over.
Yeah. It's crazy. Yeah. It's all iMessage for everything. And
it's a popular app on iOS, they said last year.
But the thing is, if you go by age and, you know, all my other friends who are not like, you know, school children or teenagers, they're all big mail.app and even Safari users on phone. And I know my friend up the street, another retired guy, he doesn't have a phone, but he has an iPad, which is amazing that he uses a device. And Safari is one of his, you know, and Mail on that device are two of his biggest apps. He's like, he's always running those and switching back and forth because it's the perfect size for that kind of thing.
No Safari icon on the watch, John.
Yeah, thank God. Thank God. That would just be wrong. I'm sorry. You just, I how tiny do we want to make the web? I don't know. So, but no, I'm not offended by that at all. And the thing is, that's one thing I like about the, you know, people think, you know, Apple doesn't let you configure. They lock you in a certain way. Apple doesn't care. It's like you buy the device. What do they care? You can use whatever apps you want. That's why they provide the store and however way, the way that you want to use them.
Is that entirely true? I mean, they don't let you change the default web browser.
Yeah, but that's a lot of that's not for the onerous reasons that people think it is.
No, I'm okay with that, but the fact remains that they don't. So
right, but they do let you download other web browsers and use those.
Yeah, but the utility is limited if you can't change the default, right? Same thing with an email client
or maps.
Right,
or
but for security reasons, you're actually, you know, you're always using WebKit because they're all WebKit anyway, right? So it's kind of a pointless thing, right?
Well, it used to be a bit more of a point when the JavaScript engine was accelerated only inside Safari, which
because we did that to screw other people.
Exactly.
No,
yeah.
No,
and I'm trying to preempt you to beat you to the punch. Right. Yeah. It's for security reasons. I understand. Yeah, but and that's even been fixed now.
I wonder if that's going to change though soon. I mean, I know that one of the big pushbacks for why we never had services, you know, what available on iPhone or on iOS services. If you're not familiar with it, the OS X style services or something similar to that, right? An iOS flavored form of services was some real concern that was just going to be a dumping ground for developers who just want to get their, you know, get their apps kind of in, you know, in the user's face in yet another way. And maybe it wouldn't provide, you know, real utility, but hey, look, you can
there's
use
a certain amount of truth to that.
To browse the window, you know, browse.
There's a certain amount of truth to that. You know that, don't you?
Oh, of course there is. Yeah. And that was, well, and by the way, that was Forstall, right? Who was sort of, you know, really at the time anyway, who was really sort of putting his foot down on that and saying that, well, yeah, we don't want to give developers a way to just kind of trash out the experience for everybody, right? Just the act of downloading an app should not make it so that the user has to have this app or some subset of that app in their face everywhere, just because the developer wants it to be there, right?
Which is remarkable because services is a next technology and Forstall is an next guy, right? So it's interesting that he's, you know, arguing to throw that under the bus, basically, or to not implement it inside iOS. Because services is relatively
easy. That's part of the strength of being a good decision maker is not letting those kinds of prejudices.
I agree. I'm saying that this is further evidence that he is a good decision maker, not bound by some weird loyalty thing that he.
Well, yeah,
feel.
But well, you know, and also, just like any other exec, he got wild hairs up his ass too about certain things. But
sure. But not to put too fine a point on it. But you know, maybe the list of available apps that were, you know, the apps that were available to you if you had a Next box was a little bit different than the apps that are available to you and the ecosystem that an iPhone has, right? If you're working on Next, you're maybe looking for any way that you can have applications provide as much utility as possible.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure you could have bought every app that ever shipped for the Next and, you know, still have money to spare,
So I think the environment is a little different. But yeah, to his credit, I mean, I think that was not just a, oh yes, we have it on this platform, we should have it on that platform too.
Right.
Right? Yeah, he's doing what's right for users and for the platform.
Yeah, I think you have to be circumspect about those kinds of things. But I get really annoyed when people are lazy in the other media, not the media that you're involved with, Renee, who ascribe these like just completely draconian motivations or evil Machiavellian schemes to Apple, when it's just, sorry, it's really not that way at all. You know, sometimes it's just, you know, as a manager, a lot of times you go around and you see a lot of stuff and you get three responses. Yes, no, not now. And sometimes the reason why Apple doesn't do something is just simply because someone said, not now, because you have other priorities, other things to do and stuff like that. It's not no, and it's not no, no, because I want to screw people. It's, you know, it's never that case either.
Cobra Commander is not running the development schedule.
Yeah, exactly. Who?
What?
Nope. Yeah. Who has who wants to do that? I mean, you know, sometimes I would hear a missive come down from marketing and I think it would be like kind of arbitrary until I sat in a room with Phil and, you know, heard his rationale on something, you know, if he would articulate that. And I went, well, yeah, that makes sense. I can go for that reasoning. But it was never like, how can we screw users? How can we lock them in? Nobody is sitting counting beans at Apple about that, or like, you know, elbowing each other and snorting, our lock-in schemes working so well. Nobody ever fucking said that. That never came up in a meeting. Just inane shit that people would describe. You know, sure. Apple wanted to control things, but not for the reason everybody on the outside thinks. They wanted to control things and deals and environments and stuff like that, because when they controlled, they could create better experiences. It was not about the money.
Well, the money doesn't hurt.
The money doesn't hurt, but I never heard somebody bring it up that if we control this, then we're going to get the dollars. It was never that. Yeah. Never that.
In fact, I think a lot of the control or strong desire to have that control actually did come out of some of the older days as well, right? When right. There was a time when Apple didn't control the development tool story and had to make a major transition from Motorola-based processors to PowerPC. And the Apple development tools were so bad, they were so awful, that there was another company out there called Symantec that had traditionally had some decent tools, but because they were the 800-pound gorilla as far as Mac development tools went, and Apple just willingly let that happen and really didn't work too hard to wrestle that control away from Symantec, when it came time to actually make this transition, thank goodness there was this little this scrappy right. company called MetroWorks that came along and ate Symantec's lunch, because if that didn't happen, Apple would have been fucked at that point as well. Yeah, so I think
it was
Code Warrior, MetroWorks Code Warrior. But it was
the lesson Apple learned was not even to sit on their hands. That's when Apple realized that they've got to get, you know, a real development tool story.
They have to have a real development tool story. And later on, you know, it's sort of playing into what you came and worked on. They for anything that was strategically important to Apple and to the platform that Apple was developing, things like the web, it was important for Apple to own that technology and not let a company like Microsoft with Internet Explorer dictate when a transition to Intel Macs could be made, for example, right? I mean, IE was pretty good for a while, but really it was
slower than shit, but it was actually more compatible with web standards than IE for Windows by a long shot, at least as far as CSS goes. The DOM, not so much, but CSS, yes.
So I think that really, you know, it's been those little lessons here and there, and I'm sure that there are scads of lessons on the hardware side too, and I'd love to hear those at some point. But I think that with every single one of those, Apple just learned that nobody cares about Apple except Apple. And nobody cares about you as much as you do. And nobody cares about your future as much as you do. Right. And if you've deemed something important, strategically important, you need to fight as hard for that, even if they're on the sort of the peripheral of your platform and of your products and things like that. If they're strategically important, then you need to put as much energy and money and effort into those things as you do the other things that you consider core. Because otherwise, those are just going to be ways that competitors are either going to actively fuck you out of, out of future profits and future product development, or they're just going to passively, your priorities aren't shared.
They're going to lock you out of markets. They're going to lock you out of opportunities to do cool things.
Right. And so when people see this control, I think a lot of it is sort of born out of this, again, these threats that were very, very real in times in the past. I mean, there was a time actually when Microsoft was proposing this technology called Wings. I don't know if you guys knew about this.
Oh, yeah.
Know about this.
I had to use the damn thing.
Where it was you write your app in Win32, right? And the Windows API, Win32, I think was coming, but it wasn't quite there yet. And it would shit out a Mac application out the other
that
end.
That is such an app description, and it's just the process.
And I remember this was 94, 95, somewhere around there. I remember actually being in presentation, seeing this, and realizing that, oh my God, this is only happening because Apple doesn't have any better choices at this moment. And it's only happening because Apple has ignored these products that, even though they're considered on the sort of the peripheral of product development, they're so critical when it comes time to actually having a complete story. And if you don't have all of those things filled in, you're just gonna hose yourself. And there's not gonna be much you can do at that moment when you're scrambling.
Yep.
So was it a strategy motivated by fear or just a healthy respect for oblivion? I don't know how better to put that.
I think it's just understanding that these are all the different ways that people who may seem like they're your allies could actually be are actually your competitors, right?
Yeah. Dependencies are bad, right? I mean, to use this coding term. And this is dependencies in the business space, effectively, right?
Right. Right. Exactly. And it could even be, it doesn't have to be malicious either, right? It could even be that, hey, and I don't think this was the case way back when, but maybe it was that, hey, Symantec really just couldn't make a business case for developing for Macintoshes when there was a 10% market share, whatever it was back then.
Right.
Why would they retool everything and why the transition to PowerPC was nowhere near as important to Symantec as it was to Apple. So they're going to prioritize it accordingly. Yeah. And by doing that, they're fucking Apple.
Yeah.
And nobody cares about that except Apple.
Well, right? I mean, one of the things that you worked on, Carbon, alleviated exactly that kind of pain, right? That was the entire point of it.
Exactly. And that was one of the ways that you could sort of play, technical jujitsu and kind of make it so that, some of these things can actually work for you, right? Sort of paring down the API and making it so that it can work on two very different platforms and still, and work closely with MetroWorks at that time, who was, I mean, they were fantastic to work with.
Yeah. They're young and scrapping coming up, right? Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. They were young. The problem they had is they didn't keep that same sort of thing going. So.
Sad. No, but whenever they got nuked by Xcode, so
yeah,
problem solved.
Right.
Problem solved.
Although
Xcode was awful hard to swallow, even for some people inside Apple for a long time. I mean, the Finder for years was still written in Code Warrior.
Yeah, it's because it was based on what's it called?
PowerPlan.
Thank you. Yeah. Oops.
And I think that was until 10.3 or 10.4.
Oh yeah,
it's pretty late.
I was at least 10.3. Yeah.
Yeah.
So is Apple to that point? Is Apple now dependent on anything that you guys can identify?
Well, oddly enough, they're dependent on Samsung. From what I understand on chips, which is talking about irony. General. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, and what's that company that just filed for? I don't know if they're dependent on it for bankruptcy today. The Sapphire.
The Sapphire Glass.
Sapphire Glass thing. So,
T-Advanced.
Did you have something?
So, I don't know.
I was going to bring up TSMC. I thought that. I mean, I'm not sure.
Oh, yeah.
who's making the A8 processor? Is that
it's
still
TMC,
Samsung?
I believe, but I mean, there's still like there's flash chips and there's sorry, like NAND flash, not Adobe Flash, but the NAND flash yeah. chips,
the other
the
kind
RAM
of flash.
Chips.
Right. Exactly. I mean, you know, and I see that as all sort of the same type of story, right? It's one day your partners will become your competitors, or if they don't. You know, at the very least, your partners are going to have different priorities than you do.
Mm-hmm. And nobody should ever fault Apple for worrying about that kind of thing. Look at the number of times they got hosed by this kind of shit in the past. I mean,
well, there was
those lessons stick for a long damn
sure.
time.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's what I'm saying, right? This isn't like, you know, C. Montgomery Burns, like stroking his cat, thinking about how he's going to fuck the little guy and who can I Sherlock today or anything
yeah, exactly.
like that. Right? It's doing the best thing. It's trying to ship the cheapest, you know, best products as fast and as wide as possible.
Well,
right?
This is a problem for, you know, this is why you don't see hardware startups doing phones.
I was just going to say it's interesting.
The scale.
I was just going to say that it's interesting that the dependencies that you guys picked up on were all on the hardware side.
Oh, yeah.
I can't think of any on the software side. I mean, what, maybe Exchange support? Maybe, you know?
You want still?
Well, I got to say
nuance,
on
maybe,
Exchange,
maybe.
I got to say on Exchange, the Microsoft guys were actually pretty reasonable to deal with.
Oh, no, I don't
that
mean...
That could be a lot worse.
Sure, no, I don't mean it that way or that anything
is
in jeopardy. I just mean it in terms of actual things, like dependencies. I'm sure the semantic people were awesome too, up until it was not awesome.
Oh, but if you think about like Nuance or you think about Azure or S3, I mean, there's a lot of server technology that they're still outsourcing.
Yeah, I guess Nuance is probably the big one.
My understanding is they keep fleshing out that Boston office full of speech experts, but who knows how long that takes.
It feels to me like it didn't feel to me by the time I left, based on the deals that I knew about, it didn't feel to me like the Nuance dependency was as big a threat as it could have been. It felt to me like terms were favorable enough for Apple that they were comfortable with it.
I mean, the other thing is when we're talking about semantic, we're talking about the development tools, which can block everything.
Like, right.
You literally get the rug pulled out from under you. Which
right.
Which is not the case with Nuance or Exchange or what have you. Yeah.
Right. But I remember even during and Don, you might have been there for some of these too. But I remember there were, you know, during comm meetings with Avi, where the Finder team is just screaming that they're not going to use GCC and they're not going to use GDB because they were just so much worse than the MetroWorks tools that they had access
to
at the time.
And they were in the beginning.
and they were certainly worse at the beginning, but you know, Avi's point was you need to stick with this and you need to work with the project builder, then Xcode team to make it so that these things work well for you. Because if they don't work well for the Finder, then they're not going to work well for outside company, you know, outside third parties either. And now we're in this position where, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, I could be saying something really stupid here, but it doesn't feel to me like there's this huge outpouring of angst against Apple for having Xcode as their development tool
Well, I think there's a constant drumbeat of, oh my God, the tools are annoying, but
yes.
I don't know if that's...
I hear stuff like that, and I do occasionally look at the tweets from the What the Fuck Xcode account, which I think are hysterical sometimes. But you got to remember, and I were there when it wasn't called Xcode. It was called Project Builder. And you talk about the pain. It's a pleasure to use Xcode. Now it's just so night and day. It's not the same thing anymore. It's just wonderful. Because Project Builder was awfully damn painful in the beginning. Would you agree?
Oh my God. You hated it, Neaton? Maybe I'm just alone in the ocean here, but I didn't have to really use it in anger, right? Like I was doing hobby projects. So
I was, even
tell
them
some war stories.
Then.
You got them. You got
oh well,
some
I
stories.
I, gosh, none come to mind. I was just going to say whenever I was building code, I always fell back to the command line. I always use Xcode build.
So did I.
Or PB build. PB build that became Xcode build later than that. And so I was sort of freed from, you know, from having to use the IDE for anything other than just browsing text files, right? Or browsing source files.
Yeah. So, Rogue Amoeba does that, I think, to this day.
Who does that?
Rogue Amoeba, like the first indie company I worked for.
Yeah.
They had their own like build chain system because it was like Xcode was done kind of unreliable. Well,
the build system for WebKit is invoked from the command line. So with Xcode build. So there's lots of systems that are like that. And the Xcode team got really used to supporting that kind of thing. They make sure that stuff works. But the actual development, you know, using the editor, looking up symbols, everything else, that's always done from the GUI and things like that. You know, there's the odd person that's using Emacs or or Vim or like me, BBEdit, you know, but for the most part, it's the development side of Xcode. But the early editor, the early environment and everything else like that, it had a lot of bad hair days. So and you know, we stuck with it. And it's not like the team was trying to screw us up. They were trying to prove that. One big decision that made a lot of difference, believe it or not, which we all thought was a little nutty at first, was, you know, we got to get something better than GCC, because I remember sitting in meetings when we were talking about performance, because people were always complaining about performance. That's where you would always hear the Finder team, their last cranks were not about the frameworks and things like that, because, you know, even they realized that PowerPlant, you know, sucked after all those years not being updated. But it was the performance of GCC was so bad.
Mm-hmm. Now, are you talking about compiling? Like
the speed of compilation compiling? Compilation performance was so
okay,
bad.
Not code gen. Yeah.
Not code gen. It's compilation speed. And I think that's one of the that is also one of the things that convinced Bertrand, that who was in charge by that time, that we had to have our own compiler, essentially. Talk about Apple in control.
Just grab
and do another
ladder.
Thing is, you know, yeah. We give it away as LLVM, you know, and Clang give it away, but we had to get something where we could really, you know, have something that was not a big beast like that, and that we could bring it into the modern age where, you know, we weren't slaves to, you know, change, you know, one carriage return in a header file, and then, you know, that was another 2 hours shot to hell. You know, we had to get past that kind of nonsense and stuff like that. So I think that's one of the things that brings up investments like that. Yeah, and Apple has just done stuff like that repeatedly. You know, it's a funny thing. I think one of the things I suggested for the agenda for the meeting today, which I'm sure we don't have time for today, but this reminds me some of those stories as war stories from release times, you know, the big deadlines, the big software releases, both on iOS and OS X. And I'm sure, as I said in the email, I'm sure Nitin's got a hell of a lot more stories than I do, because he's just been there longer. But one of these days, we got to go back to that and tell some of those stories for people.
Because waiting for a part three.
Yeah, well, yeah they'll probably be bugging us for that. And oh, by the way, you know, I was complaining about reporters and stuff like that. Most of the things we got in terms of feedback were just tremendously positive accolades and thank yous. And people were so sweet, just so nice. And I got to tell you, you just done an absolute bang up job of reply. I know, because I get all the same, you know, on the same list. I get all the same email tweets. You've just done a bang up job replying to all those tweets, the nice things.
Yeah. That, I'm glad you bring that up. Yeah. So anybody who's tweeted us thanking us for the podcast, thank you. It's so nice to get those positive comments, even if it takes you 10 seconds to write them, it's, you know, puts a little grin on my face. So I'm very happy to receive those. So please keep them coming, and I'll see. Hopefully I can keep up with the fire hose of tweets coming in, but it's, yeah, I feel very fortunate that they've been very well received.
I agree. I think we were taking a little bit of umbrage at the characterization in the press. All of the feedback that we get from regular listeners is super positive. Even people that have a particular bone to pick with me are often super
I can't remember who it was, but I thought their feedback was just hysterically funny, and you took it the right way, because you're a stand-up guy who said I think he said at first, it's like, guy, were you even in the podcast?
Yeah, I know. Well, I mean, when you guys are on a roll, you're on a roll. Like, what am I, I'm not going to stand in front of that boulder.
Yeah. So that was very nice of you. And I've actually continued to have conversations with some people who gave feedback, because they had really good questions. You know, they wanted to know additional things, and these people are not, you know, reporters and stuff like that. And you can tell they're not by the way they ask the questions. They're
right. Nobody's looking for an angle. Right?
Yeah. Nobody's looking for an angle.
So
there
just
were,
to be clear, that's at Don Melton, Don Melton, and at Nitin Ganatra, Nitin Ganatra.
Yeah. It's not Ganatra Nitin as a.
No, that guy never made a phone.
Yeah, exactly. What's he ever done?
Yeah, so but one fellow apparently transposed it, and the I guess that's the actor.
Yeah, he's Bollywood something. Famous.
Yeah, he's Bollywood famous. He replied with a fairly hysterical tweet. I think it was yesterday to the fellow.
That's awesome.
Yeah. So
every now and then, I think that if I ever find myself in London, I'd love the chance to look him up and. Hopefully, you know, get a picture of the two of us together and tweet that.
Oh, please do. See, he seemed like a really, looking at his Twitter stream, seemed like a cool guy. So
he's very down to earth. Yeah, yeah. Well, and I think it's more up to him than to me. he's a big celebrity. I mean, he's pretty famous.
You and I are like in a very tiny way internet famous, but that doesn't mean a hell of a lot. So
no.
And thank God for that, you know. So anyway, those stories from the last lines. The reason why I was thinking about that was because of I'm thinking about a lot of my friends at Apple right now, because, you know, who just squeezed iOS 8 out, and many others are in the process of squeezing Yosemite out, and all the fire drills and software updates and stuff like that. And you know, there's some things that happened in the last minute that are just really nutty. And some that you just want to bury your head in your hands over, and others that you're actually very proud of. But it goes back to the stressful aspect of the job. That's part of it, dealing with those deadlines. And it is just, you know, it's like, who's that composer who does those constantly ascending beats to scores in movies? Anyway, it has just gotten faster and faster and more things at Apple over the years. I remember when basically Steve decided we're going to do an iOS release every year, whereas on Mac, we were doing like, I think the quickest we ever did a release was probably Cheetah, which was what? It was something like one. It was less than 1 year. It was like 11 months, right? Or 8 months?
Yeah, it was Cheetah to, I think it was Puma.
Yeah, was Puma. 10, Puma. Cheetah 10, to
yeah.
Puma.
1, right? Yeah, right. 10.0 was kind of.
Yeah, and we were never able to do that again until years later when Federighi decided we're going to be on an iOS-type schedule.
Yeah, 10.1, let alone fact, the first free version.
Yes.
The first free update version, because...
Well, let's be honest, 10.0 just kind of sucked. It was the Dancing Bear release of macOS 10.
I was happy to have it, and that's all I'll say about
that. I was impressed with it. It was one of the reasons
you were
I worked
to have 10.1.
I was, yeah.
It was one of the reasons I went to work at the company. I was so impressed with the technology and the beauty of it and everything else, but it was just slower than shit. And, you know, even working at Apple, you'd have to reboot into OS 9 just all the time to do stuff. So
fun times.
Yeah, fun times. So, some stories about that, because you know, is at about the time that we retired, you and I probably thought it was getting pretty hectic there. But now with the watch, and from what I understand, talking to my peeps, the new release schedules where things are overlapping even more than they used to, it's getting a little nutty there.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. I
hope nobody blows a gusset.
I do worry a little bit about that as well. I mean, that was one of the things that that came out sort of as one of the postmortems for back in 2007 for Windows Vista. Was back at the time there was this concern that before any feature or anything like that could come out, it had to span all of Microsoft's product lines at the time. And so because of that, because there was this dependency that was built in on all of the other products that were coming out, it meant that development on all of them was slowed. And so I worry a little bit that hopefully this isn't something that Apple backs its way into, is, you know, is having too many of these dependencies, and because of that, meaning that, you know, making it so that nothing can come out as quickly as Apple wants it to. I'm sure much smarter people than me are on it and worried about it and thinking about it now. But just from the outside, that's one of the things that I do worry about a little bit is, you know, once you pick up these dependencies, it's a fantastic story to the outside world that, hey, look, we've got this, you know, this feature parity with the newest release of iOS, and we've got the newest release of OS 10, and now we've got this Apple Watch. And they're all coming out, and they're all going to work together seamlessly with one fell update or three fell updates, fell swoops, right, or whatever it is. But in order to do that, there's a lot of coordination that has to go into it. I mean, there's a lot of coordination that has to go into implementing a feature just on any one platform. Mm-hmm. So now if you're talking about three different platforms run by three different organizations with three different sets of sort of supporting supporting facilities and things like that you've now introduced an awful lot of complexity into the development process.
I did wonder if the necessity, the marketing driven necessity, or at least the perceived necessity of having a major new OS version for both the Mac and the phone, and I presume the watch at some point, is untenable over a long run, right?
I guess we'll find out, huh?
Well, I mean, like the devices did, you know, 4 or 4S, that kind of thing. Maybe the OS needs to do a TikTok kind of thing, too. Because I don't know. I don't know how you can keep cramming all these new features. Like, people think a year is a long time. A year is not a long time for a piece of software of the complexity that we're discussing.
Well, right. You know, it's funny you mention that and mention Microsoft, because Microsoft is trying to get out of their fuck it up, fix it cycle, you know, maybe numbering the new OS 10, you know, so they can beat the numbering curse. I have no idea what the hell they're doing there.
Was that legit? That did the internet rounds, but basically just for the listeners, it was people trying to check the version number of Windows would check for a string that said Windows space 9 for 95 or 98, and then switch some, you know, functionality. Was that legit?
I have no idea. I have no idea how Microsoft does stuff. What we heard about, here's when I knew Microsoft was doomed for the OS. I was at Apple. This was around, I think it was only like, I think it was Panther. Mm-hmm. Hell, it might have been Tiger. We were working on stuff, and, you know, a new OS at Apple comes out every day. sometimes more than one. And when we brought the phone around, that kept up, you know, even on steroids. So we would do generally a full build of the whole list, a clean build, like every 2 weeks. And we were doing depend builds multiple times a day. Well, we had heard through the grapevine at Microsoft at that time. This was in, I don't know, I guess that's around, what, 2007? That they couldn't even build their whole OS even once a week. Depend build or whatever.
Yeah.
And yeah, I was like, yeah, how the fuck are they going to get anything done? Yeah. So
I think Ryan Nielsen was on the show and he said the same thing.
Yeah. And, yeah, and it's like they're, you know, that's a real description of what's wrong with Vista. So I think they're trying to get out of that world.
Right.
And that's what the new OS group at Microsoft's trying to do. But again, this is one thing Apple's really good at. They figured that out years ago. That's what happens when you don't have enough people. You have to figure that out.
Blessing and a curse.
Mother of invention. Yeah.